Let's turn now to U.S. foreign policy. Andrew Bacevich, professor emeritus of history and international relations at Boston University, writes in the Boston Globe that during President Trump's first overseas trip last week, Trump, quote, simultaneously affirmed and recast the war on terrorism. And in doing so, he almost guarantees its continuation in perpetuity. Well, that recasting of the war on terror can be heard in Trump's speech to the Arab Islamic American Summit in Riyadh last week.
But no discussion of stamping out this threat would be complete without mentioning the government that gives terrorists all three, safe harbor, financial backing, and the social standing needed for recruitment. It is a regime that is responsible for so much instability in that region. I am speaking, of course, of Iran.
Well, Andrew Bacevich joins us now. Professor Bacevich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much.
So first of all, by focusing on Iran, how exactly is President Trump recasting the war on terror?
Well, let's rerun the videotape here. Go back to 2001 when the main target of the war on terror was Al-Qaeda. The George W. Bush administration then rather quickly fingered Saddam Hussein's Iraq as the sponsor, supporter, auxiliary. And so we went about invading Iraq because that was going to solve the problem. Here we are all these years later, and now our current president says that all along, apparently, Iran has been the villain, and Iran now becomes the principal target of this ongoing enterprise.
But Professor, I mean, if I may, and I'm sad to say it's been so many years, I'm not 100% sure I remember this correctly, but I mean, wasn't Iran always part of the mix with the Axis of Evil, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, when George W. Bush was trying to provide a larger frame looking beyond Iraq, he did say that we were up against this Axis of Evil, which included not only Iran, but also, for whatever bizarre reasons, North Korea. As a practical matter, however, the focus of attention was primarily, for George W. Bush, was primarily on Iraq and to a lesser degree on Afghanistan, since that's where the Al-Qaeda conspiracy was concocted in the first place. There was no war against Iran at that junction.
I see. So the distinction you're making is a more militaristic language from President Trump specifically regarding Iran than we've heard before. Because you know, I was thinking back, and I honestly can't remember a time from President Reagan on forward where Iran hasn't been the target of some kind of bellicose U.S. rhetoric, though.
Well, I mean, I think actually that was changing in the second term of the Barack Obama administration. Remember that I think in many respects, Obama's principal foreign policy achievement was the successful negotiation of the nuclear weapons deal with Iran, which in exchange for some economic concessions led to Iran's commitment not to develop nuclear weapons. I'm in the camp that believed that opening had the potential to lead to a broader engagement with Iran, and that in the best case, that broader engagement could actually lead to some sort of restabilization of the region. Hmm. What we now hear from the current president, although it appears that he's not going to abrogate the Iran nuclear deal, what we're now hearing from him is clear signals he has no intention of using that as an opportunity to lead to any further engagement. On the contrary, he's identifying Iran as our principal adversary, very much pleasing Saudi Arabia and Israel by making that statement.
Right. So about the Saudis and Israel, I want to get back to that in just a second. But in your op-ed, you write that in blaming Iran for terrorism, that President Trump is essentially ignoring the root problem here. But I was looking back at a June 2016 State Department report that identified Iran as the number one state sponsor of terror. So I wonder, I mean, perhaps the president isn't too far off on the mark here, because can't U.S. foreign policy be seen as an effective way, or the tools of U.S. foreign policy be seen as an effective way to diminish the role of state-sponsored terrorism, whereas conventional policy tools that we have perhaps are not as effective as at getting to those root causes of terrorism, which may have more to do with religion and sectarian conflict, and as you know better than anyone else, a century of dark history in the Middle East that the United States is a major part of.
Yeah, I think it is fair. I take the point that you are making is that there is this thing called root causes that may or may not be responsive to military action, but there are terrorist actions, terrorist conspiracies where military action may be necessary, at least in the interim. But what I would say is, regardless of what the State Department says about Iran being the principal sources of terror, they're sure not the only ones. And indeed, if we're looking for states that sponsor terrorism, it's important, I think, to look at states like Saudi Arabia, where there is an abundance of evidence that Saudi Arabia has been a supporter, a promoter of a intolerant form of Islam that serves as a breeding ground for jihadism and jihadist violence.
Right. Let me jump in here, Professor Amin, because I think this is an extraordinarily important point. I mean, why do you think that not just Donald Trump, but I would say even Barack Obama, George W. Bush, no recent president that I can remember has explicitly criticized the Saudi royal family for being the number one exporters and supporters, financially and otherwise, of radical Wahhabism around the world?
Well, great question. I don't believe I have an adequate answer. I think that there are multiple factors involved. One of them is a U.S.-Saudi relationship dating back to World War II, which may well have served U.S. interests during the Cold War, and which the political establishment or the national security establishment in Washington is somehow unwilling to reexamine and revisit, notwithstanding the fact that so much has changed since that relationship was forged. When that relationship was forged, it was because there was an appreciation in Washington of the importance of oil, of the importance of the oil in Saudi Arabia. There was an anticipation that the United States would become increasingly dependent upon foreign oil. All that was true in the near term. It's not true today. So we live in a world today where, whether for good or for ill, our way of life is still dependent upon having access to cheap gasoline, to overstate it slightly. But we don't need to get that gasoline from Saudi Arabia. So there is this reluctance, I think, to revisit some of the assumptions that underwrote the U.S.-Saudi relationship in the first place. And, of course, you have to also throw into the mix Israeli concerns, and the way that plays in our domestic politics.
Yeah. You know, in your op-ed, you even go a step further, and you write clearly that you think there's another player here, and that's the military-industrial complex, right? You say follow the money.
Well, it's because I don't find the strategic argument for this aligning ourselves with the Saudis and targeting Iran. I don't find the strategic argument persuasive. And therefore, you say, well, what else is going on? And what else? One of the other things is going on that was really one of the headlines of the president's visit to Saudi Arabia is a massive increase in Saudi weapons purchases from the United States. $100 billion, more than $100 billion, potential for three times that over the course of a decade. And I don't for a second believe that the military-industrial complex somehow controls U.S. foreign policy. I do believe it influences foreign policy, and I think we see that influence quite clearly as one of the factors that is shaping the Trump administration's policies toward that part of the world.
Could there be some strategic benefit to having a president who speaks about Iran in more muscular tones? I mean, could the rhetoric, I mean, I hope this doesn't sound naive, but could the rhetoric actually lead to some form of better ability, containment with Iran, containment of Iran, if, you know, they're looking at the United States as a stronger player?
I suppose that is possible, and I guess one of the reasons why I don't find that argument persuasive is that my own reading of the situation is somewhat different. I mean, my reading of Saudi Arabia is that it is a backward autocracy. There is very little, at least that I can see, going on within Saudi Arabia to suggest that it is on the road to reform and liberalization. And yet, when you look at what's happening in Iran, which just reelected by a substantial majority a moderate reformist president, contrast that with no elections that have ever happened in Saudi Arabia of any significance. When you look at the compelling evidence that the youthful cohort in Iran wishes to embrace secular modernity, that's a country, it seems to me, that does show very significant potential for liberalizing reform that can bring Iran more closely into alignment with our interests and our values.
Right.
And I think that's something that a far-sighted approach to statecraft would wish to explore, to test, to promote. And I think that what the Trump administration is doing is simply foreclosing that possibility. I think that's a mistake.
Professor Basevich, one last question here, because regarding that, you know, $110+ billion arms deal that the president signed with Saudi Arabia, the closing paragraph of your op-ed actually brought to mind a 1951 speech, I believe, or 1953 speech given by Dwight Eisenhower, the Chance for Peace speech, and we just wanted to play a clip of it.
Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
You wrote in your op-ed, in the months ahead, Americans on food stamps or enrolled in Medicaid may have to tighten their belts. The military-industrial complex, along with its network of clients and auxiliaries, will do just fine. I mean, is what you're writing the same choice that Eisenhower said America or the world was making back in the early 1950s?
I think to some degree. May I say, I didn't know you were going to play that tape, and I just find it incredibly moving. It's unimaginable to have a president say something like that today. And this is a president who was a five-star general. I mean, frankly, I'm grateful to you that you dug that up, because I think that it is enormously pertinent to the present moment, and it provides another reason for us to worry about the direction that this administration is taking the country.
Well, since you said that, Professor Basevich, I'm going to have my crack team here put a link to President Eisenhower's speech on our website, RadioBoston.org. And listeners, if you go there, you'll get a link to Andrew Basevich's op-ed as well. He's Professor Emeritus of History of International Relations at Boston University. Professor Basevich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.